Hello, I'm Kat Arney. In this interview, I've been sitting down with Nick Stevens, Executive Chairman of the RSA Group, and Mark Johnson, a partner at the group, to talk about RSA's latest talent equity report, focusing on the challenges facing leadership in the cell and gene therapy sector. But before we got into that, I started by asking Nick to set the scene by explaining exactly what cell and gene therapies are.
Well, cell and gene therapies come from the convergence of the science, understanding the genetic code and the emergent phenotype that comes from that, and our newly found abilities to control those, which lead to effectively the ultimate personalization of medicines.
So this is really getting into the genes and the molecules inside cells and fiddling around with them compared to, say, kind of molecular therapeutics, the kind of drugs we might be used to.
Yes, so rather than hitting a target that interrupts a biological process, what you're able to do is to fundamentally rewrite that process.
Fiddle with it, basically.
Yeah, have a play.
Getting in the biology.
Yeah, DNA is software.
And why have they become so hot right now? What do you think is maybe the key thing that's driving the interest in this industry?
I think fundamentally there's an opportunity to create cures in unmet needs from a therapeutic focus that these offer solutions to that weren't present previously.
Yeah, we have cancer on the ropes. It's one of the most exciting times in medicine since the beginnings of the HIV outbreak, I think.
And what do you feel are the opportunities for startups, companies wanting to move into this space?
Companies moving into the space tend to do it by acquisition. They need to buy their way in. New companies starting up in the space come from scientific founders, and those people are starting to demonstrate the ability to repeatedly spawn new companies using the advance of their scientific research and to attract investment in those.
And what do these new companies look like?
They emerge much more fully formed than your typical scientific spin-out. I think that's partly to do because of the pace of development of cell and gene companies. They develop much more quickly, they grow in value and hit inflection points in a more predictable way. And because of that, the management teams have more to do. It's very difficult often in an early phase, typical biotech, to hire somebody at the level you want and keep them busy enough. But because of the pace of growth of cell and gene companies, you can hire a better team faster. I think that's also associated with the perceived lower risk of cell and gene. It looks as if you can understand it and that the challenge is much more tractable, much less binary, and the risks are more controllable. So investors are happy to put in more money more quickly, and that means you can hire a high quality team at the beginning.
Well, come back to the issue of the team, but Mark, I wanted to ask you, what are some of the challenges there? Because I think Nick's just made it sound quite easy. Well, it's less risk than doing a classic drug discovery, but this stuff is hard. What are the challenges that some of these companies face?
I think if you look at the challenges from day one, the extraction from scientific labs can be quite challenging. When you talk to the fund managers that invest in these companies, their selection process for the scientific founders that they want to work with is probably more rigorous than it historically was. Before it was, if it was exciting science, then they would probably invest. I think they look at that more rigorously now, with a view to trying to understand how well they can partner with that scientific founder. And I think the other challenge is the sheer pace that of growth. Previously there would be a year or two while they went into a ramp-up phase. I think that ramp-up phase is gone now. They go straight in and they go in hard. The investment is significant from day one, so you don't have that funding issue. They've got the finances, and they can attract the right sort of people. So I think that it's the sheer pace of the development that is quite challenging for them, and gluing it all together and moving it forward because it happens that quickly.
And what about the kind of technical skills that are involved? Is there a different range of scientific, of technical, of delivery skills that are needed compared to maybe a more standard drug discovery biotech?
I think if you look at the skill sets that they look for, certainly in the founding team, it's quite a significant depth of scientific knowledge. So people need to be able to look at certain situations and have a depth of experience to fall back on, because the book hasn't been written. Regulators are still trying to work out what to do with it. They're getting there, but it's still not clear exactly what the best strategies are. So you need people that have a sufficient depth of experience previously to say, well, if this happens, then we think this would probably be the best course of action. So I think finding and attracting those people, particularly with the number of biotechs that are springing up in this area over the last year or two, and the numbers that they are looking to recruit is becoming, the candidate pool is not shrinking, but the number of companies that are going in seriously are increasing significantly.
And there's almost the opposite picture with the, if you like, the downstream, the lower levels in organisations, as there is at the management team level. For example, if you want to make cell and gene therapies, typically that's done by a postdoc scientist now. And so you're asking postdoc scientists to be production line operatives, which is the domain more typically of less well-educated people who have decided that this is where they are going to finish their careers, not people who are at the beginning of their careers. There's a time bomb, I think, with workforce in manufacturing, in supply chain.
I think if you look at the model, so if you looked at your average biotech in monoclonal antibodies a few years ago, you talk about strategy. We're gonna be virtual. We'll maybe do a bit of development, but we'll farm that straight out to a CMO and then manage that relationship. So when you were recruiting, you'd probably be looking at the senior leadership team to manage those external relationships. If you look at cell and gene therapy, because of the need, you know, from a valuation perspective, they need to show that they've got control of the manufacturing process. So those in the earlier years were maybe looking at doing it virtually and farming out. I think increasingly over the last 2 or 3 years, everybody is building manufacturing facilities. They want control of their manufacturing process and their development. They might be farming elements of it out. So all of a sudden you've had, you know, 4 or 5 companies looking to hire 100, 150 people in the UK of a fairly high skill level. And you look at the candidate pool as it stands, you know, even if you were to pull everybody that's out there at the moment and put them into these companies, you would probably still be coming up short on what's needed. And then with the Brexit and bringing people in from Europe, that's becoming increasingly challenging at the mid to lower levels as well. So I think that's a real challenge for them at the moment.
We'll come on to the kind of skills that the senior leadership need to handle those kind of challenges. But let's dig in a little bit more to what senior leaders could do to try and get a workforce, to try and bring in these people, given that the pool is not very deep.
It's an interesting question. I think this is where organisations like the Catapults have a role to play. We need to find ways of making those tasks easily replicatable. And we need to find a way actually to lower the level of education and skill necessary. As the industry develops, that will become more and more easy to do. But today, it is the people coming out of the scientific labs who then find themselves on a production line.
Does it have to be someone with that very, very high level of technical skill? Could you look at someone who maybe doesn't have the precise skills you're looking for, but they've got smarts and they, you know, they're good with their hands?
I think if you look at how the cell therapy market's changed from day one, so when you had these biotech companies starting to spin out, so when the Catapult was created and the Syncona companies started coming to the fore, at that point when you were running searches and they were saying we'd like cell therapy experience, the candidate pool was all academic, had no idea how to commercialise, you know, great scientist, but when you're starting to talk about commercialising a drug product, had no hands-on experience. And at that point, the next best was people that had good vaccines experience in development and launched, or people that had been around in the earlier days of monoclonal antibodies, so been gone through similar processes where nobody knew how the processes weren't defined, the regulators still couldn't get their heads around exactly what to do with it, supply chain was complicated, pricing was unclear. So if you look at the people that were doing monoclonal antibodies back in those days, they've got the skill sets at least to understand, okay, well, this is how we deal with these scenarios. So they've been through it. The sciences may be slightly different. At that point, they were good skill sets to transfer in, because it didn't actually really exist at that point. I think that's gone full circle in the last few years, because there are people coming through with those those skill sets. So now all the companies want that experience. So I think the market probably needs to realise that it's available, but there are a finite number of people with this experience, and the industry is growing too quickly.
And that's particularly true in disciplines like regulatory affairs, where you need people to have enough depth of scientific understanding, but also of process understanding, to help a third party, the regulator, through the thinking of how to regulate this new space. So the opportunity at the senior level for veterans to come in to add value and to use the relationships they've developed with investors, regulators, customers, healthcare systems, in ways where that depth adds real value both to patients and to the investors, are high.
Let's have a bit of a deeper dive into the challenges that are maybe unique to the cell and gene therapy sector as companies are going through this journey from the bright idea in the lab to, oh, okay, we've developed this, maybe this will work, getting it through the next stages and then maybe ultimately to market. What are some of the key challenges that are faced by leadership in that sector?
I believe the biggest challenges will come as more and more gene and cell therapies get into patients. And as we scale that journey and as more and more people are given access to those medicines, it's more appropriate that developed larger pharma companies are involved in that process. What that means for cell and gene companies is that they need to think early about partnership, about relationship management, and about understanding how they'll integrate what they do today with what a large pharmaceutical company will need to do in the future.
Conventionally, there may have been the idea that for a biotech company, they're going to get to a certain point and then they're going to have an exit strategy that involves selling to a big pharma. Are there different models? What are the sort of challenges there that different companies are approaching in different ways?
I think the cell and gene therapy biotechs that you talk to these days are coming at it with a view that they are looking to build a company, a pharmaceutical company.
That
tends to be that there are potential inflection points along the route. There should be an IPO. They may talk about potential acquisition. I think if you look at those acquisitions, whereas it used to be probably asset stripping previously, it's more about the technical capability now. So when the larger pharma companies are acquiring them, they're acquiring the staff as well as the drug. And previously, you know, if the acquisition would go through, the staff would probably get made redundant because there was a capability elsewhere within the organisation. They are buying the assets or the potential of the assets and the individuals now. So the larger pharma companies are taking them out to headquarters, engaging with the staff, and really trying to maintain the technical capability themselves because they don't necessarily want to try and develop it themselves.
Let's turn now to the kinds of skills that are going to be needed for the leaders of these kind of companies. What sorts of people are you starting to look for? What sorts of people are needed, those skill sets that are going to make a company successful?
I think if you look at there's been a change in the biotech space, and I think predominantly brought around by cell and gene therapies. If you look historically and you were looking for senior leadership people, you'd look for people with previous biotech experience. People from a large pharma background would tend to be viewed as not appropriate, wouldn't understand biotech, wouldn't fit. I think given the pace that they're evolving at and the fact that predominantly they will either be looking to partner with a large pharma company or sell to a large pharma company, increasingly people from the large pharma companies, or at least a good degree of exposure to large pharma, is viewed as a positive from the biotechs. There's candidates that I put forward for a role now that 5 years ago the client would have raised an eyebrow and gone on really, and now they're looking at them as the sort of people that will fit quite well. So I think they're looking for, tends to be a balance of some senior level pharmaceutical experience and an appreciation of biotech at some point at least.
That's the experience and background. What about the softer skills? Has that changed from the kind of things that make a good leader? What would you say is going on in the kind of search there?
Right at the top of organisations, I think that the softer skills become much more important. If you're growing an organisation at the pace that you can grow cell and gene companies, maintaining culture, maintaining direction, are much more important than in the more binary development of a typical biotech.
Yeah, I think if you look at the companies that do well, it tends to be that they have quite a firm vision of, it's almost a journey. You know, you go in and talk to them and you get a feel for, it's about driving. Is the key driver tends to be that they're in an unmet need, that there's a commitment to patients to make a difference, that they're all coming on board because the leadership team can paint a colourful picture of the vision for the company, the journey, and what that means for patients. So their primary focus is, you know, that there's some opportunity to really make a significant difference to people's lives. And I think most of the successful biotechs, the leadership team are good at expressing that, and people come on board because they want to be part of it. Everything else is somewhat secondary to wanting to make a difference. And I think a lot of these people, when you talk to them, when you place them 3, 4, 5 years ago and talk to them where they are now, and you know the clinical trials are progressing and patients that they've had an impact and it's looking like the drug's going to be licensed, that they really feel they've added value. And I think that's probably the differential.
For the leadership and people in cell and gene companies, it's much more like the orphan drug space than it is a typical biotech, in that they might even know the first names of the patients who are in their clinical trials. It's a very personal connection.
When you look broadly at the senior leadership in the industry, how is it breaking down in terms of diversity, particularly gender diversity?
Our statistics demonstrated somewhat disappointingly that the profile in terms of age, gender, racial background is almost exactly the same as the rest of our industry, which means it's disappointingly undiverse.
I think if we look at the client base that we work with, it certainly doesn't concur with the statistics. The ratio of male to female tends to be significantly higher than the statistical norm. And I think that's because that there's a core focus on, certainly for these sorts of companies, in finding the right people. And maybe some of the older stereotypes don't carry across when you're looking at who can do this effectively.
Are there changes, though, in the way that people are working? I'm thinking of more flexibility, particularly because that's something you can offer someone if you're in a shortage market. You know, working remotely, working across borders.
One of the things that we have seen is that the functional teams need to be in the same geographic location. So, for example, at the moment we are working with one cell and gene company where the scientific team and the founder will stay in a particular location in Asia, where the rest of the business has been moved to Boston in Massachusetts, so that they can have access to that later stage talent they need.
And thinking more broadly about what do great leaders look like in the sector, could you paint a pen portrait of the kind of people that you'd be looking for? Are there specific characteristics that you're looking for that make great leadership in these companies?
She or he has a focus on the patient, an absolute conviction that the intervention the company can make can benefit them, and thinks about very little other than making sure they have enough money and the right people in place to advance the science and get the medicine into humans.
I think on top of that, they're very good at reiterating that vision and getting people on board and engaged. If I look at some of the biotechs we work with that are focused in cell and gene therapy, people I placed there 5 or 6 years ago are all still there, and that's 10, 15 people. They've been through IPOs, clinical trials, sales, and they're still with that company, and they don't want to move on. And I think that's because the original leadership team, which is probably slightly different from the one that's there now, had a very strong vision, and everybody bought into that. And although it's morphed and changed and developed, the key thing is still there, that they want to deliver a drug to these patients in this unmet need. And they are in, these candidates are in very short supply at the moment and are being approached on a near daily basis. But they are all engaged. And I think if you look at what makes these companies successful, it's the leadership that can get that vision and message across and get people's buy-in.
If you could give one piece of advice to the leadership team in a cell and gene therapy company that would help put them on that path to success, what would you say?
I would ask them to look forward to a world where their therapy is helping significant numbers of patients and to be aware of the levels of complexity and the orders of magnitude more difficulty that single medicines for single patients bring than a more generally used therapeutic.
Mark, have you got one piece of advice?
I think if you're giving a CEO advice as to what they need to do with these companies, that the key thing is the engagement of the staff. Everybody from top down needs to be equally engaged. I think previously it was more about the senior management team. I think there's a realisation now that everybody needs to be engaged. Everybody needs to be part of the vision and part of the journey. I mean, everybody tends to get shares or equity these days, which they didn't do earlier on in biotech. So it's that piece of engagement. I think that's the key thing. Everything else tends to work itself out if you put the right people in and keep them engaged.
That's Mark Johnson, and you also heard from Nick Stevens. You can find the RSA Group's full talent equity report on the cell and gene therapy sector online at thersagroup.com. This podcast was produced by First Create the Media for the RSA Group and presented by me, Kat Arney. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.